Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an awesome founder, you know, a founder that he went all into it, you know, all at it. And we're going to be talking about building, scaling, you know, growing up for him, you know, having a really influential father that was a professor in some of the top schools, you know, and then also how he transitioned from a large corporation to really taking ownership of his own destiny. So again, brace yourself for a really inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Jonah Greenberger. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So originally born in Los Angeles, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Oh, it's good. I was grown into a family very focused on education. As you mentioned, my dad was a professor, born in 1931. So he actually worked on developing the ARPANET. And then his whole career was around information technology. He threw the first tech conference, and I think I met Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos when I was 10 years old. So I think that it was a really interesting environment to grow up in that kind of put a big chip off my shoulder, made me want to do something big in the world. So that's kind of where it got started.
So how do you get into the whole engineering, you know, mechanics and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I was always very fascinated by math. My dad studied math and kind of that shared that with me. But I wanted to figure out how it could have an impact in the world. And so that led me into the engineering world. I went to Stanford and studied mechanical engineering. But then the same type of thing happened where I was very focused on, you know, this is all very interesting, but why does it matter? What can I do with it? And I discovered Stanford's entrepreneurial like courses and system. And there was one group in particular called the Mayfield Fellows Program that just got me a deep dive into entrepreneurship that then opened up, you know, kind of a world of possibilities for me and got me excited to start something someday.
Now, out of all possibilities, you know, especially being at Stanford, you know, which is the land of entrepreneurship innovation. I mean, how do you land in a place like Chevron? You know, that's quite the opposite.
Yeah, it is really interesting. John Doerr is one of the, you know, godfathers of venture and entrepreneurship. And one thing he said is start your career at a big company to kind of learn how things work, learn what works, what doesn't, figure out what's broken, and then use that to figure out what you want to start and what angle you want to take. He kind of suggested that as building a really useful thing to build context, because think about it, you know, if it takes 10 to 20 years to build a successful company, really matters what you choose. And, you know, in the early days, you can only pivot so much. And so that's why I went to Chevron. I kind of planned to stay there 2 years, ended up staying there 5 years, which a little bit longer than I wanted to. And then I started this company.
So now looking back, you know, working on a company so big like Chevron, I mean, you know, talking about the guidance, you know, or what you had heard from John Doerr, from Kleiner Perkins, what were some of the things that you were like, you know, I think that if I start something one day, those are some of the areas that maybe I'll pay a little bit more attention to?
Yeah, good question. I mean, one thing I took away from Chevron, we invested in a ton of technologies, fuel cells, biofuels, some crazy stuff. And what I took away from all of those things is there's so much work and money and time needed to commercialize new technologies, and there's so much risk. And so, you know, I was always, as I mentioned, focused on what can actually have an impact during our lifetime, like what can move quickly and matter. And so it kind of pushed me to think more about trends and where the world was going and looking for adoption as a validation of, you know, an opportunity that could have an impact versus going where my mechanical engineering background would want me to do it. I did an internship at Bloom Energy, which is a solid oxide fuel cell company. I think it was Kleiner's first clean tech investment, actually. But, you know, those things take forever and are important, but I was impatient and still am. So I looked at the trends, and what we saw is the cost curve for solar panels was dropping dramatically. Energy storage as well, about 5 years behind. And it was widely applicable. We were looking at investing in geothermal projects, but you needed very specific conditions with permeable rocks and soil and a source of heat under the ground. You know, all of these other technologies, even wind and hydro, they need very specific conditions to have an impact. Solar, you just put on a roof, right? Lots of roofs all across the world, lots of sun all across the world. So that kind of brought me to the solar sector to focus on.
So then let's talk about that moment where, I mean, 5 years at Chevron, you know, it's getting to the point where you're getting too comfortable there. And so what is that moment where you're like, I think that it's time. It's time to give the notice here.
Well, there was a forcing function, which is good because I probably needed it. But this dynamic happens with most major companies, public companies in particular. GM and Cruise is a recent example. Price of oil dropped and Chevron said, all right, back to basics. We don't have more funding for these efforts right now. We need it for, you know, what we make the most money doing, where the returns are. And so then it just, you know, it wasn't terribly interesting for me to stay at Chevron anymore. Plus, I had enough conviction on focusing on solar and where the opportunity was to have an impact that it made sense to just take a leap. And it was really helpful to have that forcing function because it is incredibly terrifying to start a company, particularly if you don't have a co-founder and particularly if it's in another country where you don't speak the language. So that was a little bit terrifying.
So what were the early days like, you know, of really taking the decision and, you know, all of a sudden seeing yourself in Mexico, you know, completely different country, different language, different everything?
Yeah, it was all of the emotions. I think that every day would oscillate between being terrified that I didn't know what I was doing and I was headed in a direction that would result in nothing. And as a result, maybe I would spend years doing things that didn't matter, which I think for me was a particularly terrifying thought. And on the positive side, then I would find a possibility and all of a sudden I would think, oh my God, I'm going to change the world. You know, this will work out. And so you oscillate, you know, you almost feel bipolar oscillating on a daily basis in the early days between those emotions, but I just kept going.
So then let's talk about the, you know, what the keeping going, you know, look like, because I mean, in your guys' case, you know, the early days were also bumpy, you know, on all fronts. And I guess also for the people that are listening, what ended up being the business model of Bright? What is Bright today?
Yeah. So there was just so many things that needed to be fixed when we first went into Mexico. There's been a whole fintech revolution, but even like the hardest thing in the early days was opening a bank account, actually. It's gotten easier since then. And we came into Mexico right as Uber was coming in. And so, you know, all of that infrastructure, Rappi wasn't there, Uber wasn't there. So that part was very tricky. I would say at the same time, it led to a ton of opportunities to add value in solar. There was tons of margin stacking. Installers would show up with the wrong material and financing rates were back then like 30% plus. I mean, it was incredible. And so I was very excited about all of those things. I knew they were solvable and the industry needed it to take off. So that kind of was the fuel to keep going. Our business model evolved based on those needs, right? How do we lower the cost of solar by making the value chain more efficient and streamlining and automating it? And then how do we lower the cost of capital by actually making it easier to deploy capital and lowering default rates through accountability to the installers, to the homeowners, and to ourselves in addition? And so what that became is kind of a platform to unite sources of third-party debt. We're partnered with the Inter-American Development Bank on the debt side, for instance, to the installers and EPCs, and then to the end customer. And we bring that transaction together in a way that's fluid and lowers the cost to get solar and passes on the benefits to, well, first homes, and then we moved later to commercial and now very focused on larger industrial projects and decarbonizing manufacturing sector.
So talk to us about also, because I mean, eventually, you know, this was a big risk and a big bet. You know, you guys go there and hoping that things are going to work out. I'm sure that the early days were, you know, nerve-wracking. And, you know, until you actually found yourself like you were turning around a corner, I guess, to that point, what was that moment where you guys were like building based on data, based on versus assumptions, and that moment where things started to click for you and you were like, I think that we got it?
Yeah. It was actually when we started a student ambassador program. There were, you know, it's not a novel idea to do rooftop solar in Mexico. There were a lot of companies that had tried. Sun Edison was there. Even SolarCity bought a company called Ilios and tried to expand there. But the challenge every company faced was customer acquisition because it was a new sector. And so things that work in the US, because there is trust and there's a lot of contract accountability, just didn't work in Mexico. And what we realized is we needed to find customers through an existing channel of trust. And we experimented with a lot of things, but we realized that students cared more about helping Mexico become more sustainable and were more mission driven. And their parents and grandparents were more practical. They had been through a number of recessions. They had all sorts of scars due to debt and exchange rate fluctuations. And so we offered educational opportunities and internships to students. They then helped us open up the networks through trust. And then that's actually how we started to develop momentum in the early days. And those student ambassadors came on to be, you know, our best employees once they graduated. So it provided this great pipeline of candidates too, which is very useful given I had no network in Mexico when we first got started.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And then also candidates, data points. As you were shaping things up and polishing things to make sure that you were putting, you know, something out there that would resonate, what also did you guys get from being able to listen effectively to customers and potential customers?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was like around trust, to go back to it. It's been a very consistent theme. Like the questions they would ask is like, well, you know, what if I need more electricity? What if I sell my house? Like, what if all of these things happen? Because there's a lot of uncertainty. One customer told me, you know, our economy lurches and goes into chaos every 5 years. So if you want me to sign a 10-year, 15-year contract, like, I don't know what's going to happen 5 years from now. So how can I sign a contract that long? And really what it came down to is we needed to structure something that had flexibility and came with trust, because otherwise the conversation just came back to the customer coming up with every single possible scenario that could happen. And you can't move quickly. You can't scale that way. And also just it's impossible to address every single possible concern, even if there's a tiny, tiny chance of it. So we got super creative on the contracts and working with the Inter-American Development Bank to build in flexibility into the contract that would allow, you know, them to expand the or transfer the contracts. They could move, and that was kind of key to actually, you know, starting getting a first product rolling.
Let's talk about to capital raising, no? Because obviously, yeah, you know, something like this requires capital. How much capital have you guys raised to date?
I think it's around 100 million, half of which is debt and half of which is equity.
What's the difference between debt and equity on something like this?
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, from a monetization perspective, you can think of us as building a balance sheet. So we basically have all of these recurring cash flows. In general, we bring in debt so that we don't have to raise a ton of equity. So most of the project actually is funded by debt. You pay CapEx, you pay G&A, you pay CAC. And then where Bright is the equity. We own the projects. And in general, to get cash flow positive, you want to develop a system where you don't have to keep raising equity and you can just use debt to grow, and the projects kind of give you that cash flow to scale as well. So from a long-term perspective, we want to get to a spot where we're deploying billions, tens of billions of debt into projects. It will always need capital, but from an equity perspective, you know, we're set. We don't need more equity, and we're a standalone business. So really, equity is kind of the critical ingredient in the early stages to get up and running and get to scale. And then once you're at scale, a lot of beautiful things happen.
Now, equity is not easy, and you guys learned it too the hard way when it came to, you know, one of your deals there with a private equity firm. How was that the nerve-wracking moment of, you know, things falling apart and having to scrambling?
You know, I'd say I started the company, I think, when I was 27 or 28, and there is a lot of truth in ignorance is bliss. I did not realize how many challenges would come from the regulatory side and from the capital raising side. And what ended up happening with this capital raise, this was our Series C, we signed a term sheet for $30 million. And then the whole global economy dropped, and the firm, the private equity firm, they were almost done closing their fund, but it didn't finish. They couldn't finish it. And so we had to start all over to start the equity raise and find a new firm, and we closed it. But in the process, you know, we had to lay off half the company in order to get that runway so they could finish due diligence and what have you. And that kind of starting and stopping is extremely painful. Even before that, you know, we had AMLO as a president in Mexico, and there was a lot of regulatory uncertainty around the energy regulations, mostly focused on utility scale electricity and oil and gas. But because of that, investors got skittish for distributed generation. And so for a long time, it was very hard to raise capital because of those concerns that didn't even manifest themselves in changes in regulation that affected us. So I would say I still have hair on my head, but that was really tough. And there were a number of times we almost went out of business, and it's pretty incredible, actually, we didn't. So I don't recommend that. I don't recommend a capitally intensive business in a country with regulatory uncertainty or that's developing. It's a lot to handle.
You know, one thing that is interesting here is founders typically, they tend to focus more on valuation versus anything else. And I think that when it comes down to getting a deal done, you got to look at not only the one that has the best terms, but also the one that is the highest likely to close. I guess, how do you think founders should look at certainty when it comes down to fundraising?
I mean, I think that it's a balance, right? It's a balance between going after firms that you really want to work with and partners that you really want to work with at those firms, because, you know, you don't want to just get capital and then have the wrong partner that you have distracts you from scaling or what have you. But at the same time, as a founder, nothing turns out the way you expect it to. And so fundraising is one of those things. There's a thousand other things that never turn out. And so I'd say always important to have a plan B and C. It doesn't always have to be an additional source of capital at that moment, but you need the ability to, you know, pull this lever in the business and this other level so that you can get additional runway in case, I would say, you know, a raise doesn't go through in the timeline expected. This, by the way, is very true with debt as well. You know, especially low-cost debt never closes in the timeline they say they will. And so you need a lot of levers in order to kind of extend that timeline. I think that that's kind of what we found has worked best for us to navigate this challenge specifically.
So investors, you know, they're always betting on a vision. You know, and I think that that is not just investors, you know, also customers, employees, everyone really, you know, the future that you're living into. So if, let's say, you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Bright is fully realized, what does that world look like?
I mean, it looks like global temperatures back to where they were, you know, 50 years ago. Our goal is really reverse global warming so that we can continue to grow globally, but in a way that actually works for humanity instead of, you know, like these fires in California popping up, Florida going underwater and similar, you know, massive disasters across the rest of the world. So that's kind of where we're focused. As part of that journey, there's a couple other things that matter. We want our investors to do well. You know, we want to thank them for supporting us, but we also want them to support other companies because they have this success case that can go on and do similar things. And then the thing that I personally care about a lot is developing our employees and creating a work environment that they love, because, you know, we want to solve global warming and affect a lot of people. And that's great long term. And that's what, you know, we want to dedicate our lives to. But every day we work with people we care about at Bright, and we want them to grow and learn and be fascinated, because you feel that impact every single day if you do that. It's not theoretical. Like, you can really feel that. And so that's become a very important part of our culture as well.
So let's double click on that, you know, the culture and making sure that people are developed and that they're excited too about what's going on and where things are heading. How do you go about making sure that people are rowing at the same time with the same moves?
I mean, it's incredibly hard. It's interesting because I thought, you know, you look at these public companies and you look at the leaders and you say, oh man, they're so tough. Like, I would never be like that. And then you get into the situation and you realize, oh my God, like, the decisions I make determine if these people have jobs or not, right? And there are not easy decisions. So I would say it's a lot tougher. What I have found is that focus is like one of the most critical things. I was watching an interview last week, I think, where someone interviewed Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and said, give me one word if you could go back and say why you've been so successful. And, you know, they couldn't talk with each other. And both of them said the same word, and it was focus. And I think it's like, it's one of those concepts that sounds so obvious, but like, you never do it, right? You never end up focusing as an entrepreneur, because all these other opportunities come up and then this regulation changes or this competitor jumps in. And so you try to handle everything, and you have to really step away and say, like, every month, are we actually focused? No, we got to kill this thing. Like, we have to kill this other thing. And that's really hard, because also your team has been working on it. They're emotionally invested in it. They're going to push back, right? And those things seem so obvious to do, right? Like, why don't we go to industrial early on? Why don't we add energy storage? Why don't we do energy efficiency? Like, the market's telling us they want it. So it's incredibly hard, but focus allows your team to be successful, right? And then they enjoy their jobs, because everyone loves being successful. The last thing I'll say on that point is, I have realized in the last year, my job is in a lot of ways to make sure that Bright is the place that people can be more successful than they could anywhere else they could go, because then Bright's successful. But then also, we have a great culture where people are learning and developing quickly, and everyone wins, including our customers, investors, everyone. And I think that partially is making sure you have people that you can, like, you choose people that you know can thrive in that environment. And then you are really good at figuring out what they need. So a lot of that comes back to, like, how do you determine in an interview process, you know, in just a couple of days, how to do that? And it's, you can only get so much information. It's really hard to do.
So let's say now I put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, you know, maybe to 2014, where, you know, you think it's time, you know, for you to become an entrepreneur, to really enter the venture world. And you're able to sit down, that the younger Jonah, and give your younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, you know, given what you know now, 10 years in?
It may sound cliche, and I'm going to say two things. The first one is, like, spend more time with your customers, like, and not on the phone with them, like, with them. The information you get from watching someone's face when they interact and hear the pitch is incredibly valuable, and everyone underestimates it. And I'm sure I still underestimate how important it is. I had a coach who ran Gillette for a little bit, and he said he would literally go into people's houses when they woke up at 6 a.m. to see how they shaved. and that was the most valuable thing he did. And that's, like, you know, Procter & Gamble, it's a huge company, but their leaders still go into their customer houses at 6 a.m. and watch them shave. So that's something I think I need to be reminded of, and everyone does. And then also the second one is, go back to focus. I mean, especially as a 27-year-old, I got through school and Chevron doing a ton of things at the same time. I thought that was a good strategy, and it was not. And I think that you always need to remind yourself to focus more, because complexity grows exponentially without you realizing it. And it's, like, it's sneaky. Like, both those things are very sneaky killers. So I would say both those.
I love it. So, Jonah, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, just email me at Jonah, J-O-N-A-H, at thinkbright.mx. That's probably the best way.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, Jonah, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks, guys.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.